When Holden arrived, the crowd was still cowed by the security officers' tasers and shock prods. But from the rising tension and anger in the air, he could tell that wouldn't last long. Just behind the front line of rent-a-cops, with their non-lethal deterrents, stood a small clump of men in dark suits and sensible shoes. They carried shotguns, with the air of men who were just waiting for someone to give them permission. That would be the corporate security, then. Looking over the room, Holden felt the scene snap into place. Beyond that closed loading bay door was one of the few remaining corporate freighters loaded down with the last food being stripped from Ganymede. And this crowd was hungry. Holden remembered trying to escape a casino on Eros when it went into security lockdown. Remembered angry crowds facing down men with guns. Remembered the screams and the smells of blood and cordite. Before he knew he'd made a decision, he found himself pushing his way to the front of the crowd. Naomi followed, murmuring apologies in his wake. She grabbed his arm and stopped him for a moment. "Are you about to do something really stupid?" she asked. "I'm about to keep these people from being shot for the crime of being hungry," he said, wincing at the self-righteous tone even as he said it. "Don't," Naomi said, letting him go, "pull your gun on anyone." "They have guns." "Guns, plural. You have gun, singular, which is why you will keep yours in your holster or you'll do this by yourself." "That's the only way you ever do anything, by yourself," Holden thought. It was the kind of thing Detective Miller would have said. For him, it had been true. That was a strong enough argument against doing it that way. "Okay," Holden nodded, then resumed pushing his way to the front. By the time he reached it, two people had become the focus of the conflict. A gray-haired port security man wearing a white patch with the word supervisor printed on it, and a tall, thin, dark-skinned woman who could pass for Naomi's mother were yelling at each other, while their respective groups looked on, shouting agreements and insults. "Just open the damn door and let us look," yelled the woman in a tone that let Holden know this was something she was repeating again and again. "You won't get anything by yelling at me," the gray-haired supervisor yelled back. Beside him, his fellow security guards held their shock sticks in white-knuckled grips, and the corporate boys held their shotguns in a loose cradle that Holden found far more threatening. The woman stopped shouting when Holden pushed his way up to the supervisor and stared at him instead. "Who?" she said. Holden climbed up onto the loading dock next to the supervisor. The other guards waved their shock prods around a little, but no one jabbed him. The corporate thugs just narrowed their eyes and shifted their stances a bit. Holden knew that their confusion about who he was would only last so long, and when they finally got past it, he was probably going to get uncomfortably intimate with one of those cattle prods, if not just blasted in the face with a shotgun. Before that could happen, he thrust his hand out to the supervisor and said in a loud voice that would carry to the crowd, "Hi there, I'm Walter Phillips, an OPA rep out of Tycho Station, and here is personal representative of Colonel Frederick Johnson." The supervisor shook his hand like a man in a daze. The corporate guerrillas shifted again and held their guns more firmly. "Mr. Phillips," the supervisor said, "the OPA has no authority." Holden ignored him and turned to the woman he'd been shouting at. "Ma'am, what's all the fuss?" "That ship," she said, pointing at the door, "has almost 10,000 kilos of beans and rice on it, enough to feed the whole station for a week." The crowd murmured agreement at her back and shuffled forward a step or two. "Is that true?" Holden asked the supervisor. "As I said," the man replied, holding up his hands and making pushing motions at the crowd as though he could drive them back through sheer force of will, "we are not allowed to discuss the cargo manifests of privately owned—" "Then open the doors and let us look," the woman shouted again. While she yelled and the crowd picked up her chant, "Let us look, let us look," Holden took the security supervisor by the elbow and pulled his head close. In about 30 seconds, That mob is going to tear you and your men to pieces trying to get into that ship, he said. I think you should let them have it before this turns violent. Violent? The man gave a humorless laugh. It's already violent. The only reason the ship isn't long gone is because one of them set off a bomb and blew up the docking clamp release mechanism. If they try to take the ship, we'll... They will not take the ship, said a gravelly voice, and a heavy hand came down on Holden's shoulder. When he turned around, one of the corporate goons was standing behind him. This ship is Mao Kukowski Mercantile property. Holden pushed the man's hand off his shoulder. A dozen guys with tasers and shotguns isn't going to stop them, he said, pointing out at the chanting mob. Mr. The goon looked him up and down once. Phillips, I don't give a drippy shit what you or the OPA thinks about anything, and especially not my chances of doing my job, so why don't you fuck off before the shooting starts? Well, he'd tried. Holden smiled at the man and began to reach for the holster at the small of his back. He wished that Amos were here, but he hadn't seen him since they'd gotten off the ship. Before he reached the pistol, his hand was enveloped by long, slender fingers and squeezed tightly. How about this? Naomi said, suddenly at Holden's side. How about we skip past the posturing and I just tell you how this is actually going to work? Both Holden and the goon turned to look at Naomi in surprise. She held up one finger in a wait-a-minute gesture and pulled out her hand terminal. She called someone and turned on the external speaker. Amos, she said, still holding her finger up. Yep, came the reply. A ship is trying to leave from Port 11, Pad B-9. It's full of food we could really use here. If it makes it off the ground, do we have an OPA gunship close enough to intercept? There was a long pause. Then, with a chuckle, Amos said, You know we do, boss. Who am I actually saying this to? Call that ship and have them disable the freighter. Then have an OPA team secure it, strip it of everything, and scuttle it. Amos just said, You got it. Naomi closed up the terminal and put it back into her pocket. Don't test us, boy, she said to the goon, a hint of steel in her voice. Not one word of that was empty threat. Either you give these people the cargo, or we'll take the whole damn ship. Your choice. The goon stared at her for a moment, then motioned to his team and walked away. Port security followed, and Holden and Naomi had to dodge out of the way of the crowd rushing up the dock and to the loading bay doors. When they were out of danger of being trampled, Holden said, That was pretty cool. Getting shot standing up for justice probably seemed very heroic to you, she said, the steel not quite gone from her voice. But I want to keep you around, so stop being an idiot. Smart play threatening the ship, Holden said. You were acting like that asshole Detective Miller, so I acted like you used to. What I said was the kind of thing you say when you're not in a hurry to wave your gun around. I wasn't acting like Miller, he said, the accusation stinging because it was true. You weren't acting like you. Holden shrugged, noticing only after that it was another imitation of Miller. Naomi looked down at the captain's patches on the shoulder of her somnambulist jumpsuit. Maybe I should keep these. A small, unkempt-looking man with salt-and-pepper hair, Chinese features, and a week's growth of beard walked up to them and nodded nervously. He was literally wringing his hands, a gesture Holden had been pretty sure only little old ladies in ancient cinema made. He gave them another small nod and said, You are James Holden? Captain James Holden? From the OPA? Holden and Naomi glanced at each other. Holden tugged at his patchy beard. Is this actually helping at all? Be honest. Captain Holden, my name is Prax. Praxidike Meng. I'm a botanist. Holden shook the man's hand. Nice to meet you, Prax. I'm afraid we have to... You have to help me, Prax said. Holden could see that the man had been through a rough couple of months. His clothes hung off him like a starving man's, and his face was covered with yellowing bruises from a fairly recent beating. "Sure. If you'll see the Supertaeporns at the aid station, tell them I said..." "No," Prax shouted. "I don't need that. I need you to help me." Holden shot a glance at Naomi. She shrugged. "Your call." "Okay," Holden said. "What's the problem?" Chapter 12. Avasarala. "A small house is a deeper kind of luxury," her husband said. "To live in a space entirely our own, to remember the simple pleasures of baking bread and washing our own dishes, this is what your friends in high places forget. It makes them less human." He was sitting at the kitchen table, leaning back in a chair of bamboo laminate that had been distressed until it looked like stained walnut. The scars from his cancer surgery were two pale lines in the darkness of his throat, barely visible under the powdering of white stubble. His forehead was broader than when she'd married him, his hair thinner. The Sunday morning sun spilled across the table, glowing. "That's crap," she said. "Just because you pretend to live like a dirt farmer doesn't make Ehrenreich or Luce or any of the others less human. There's smaller houses than this with 6 families living in them, and the people in those are 100 times closer to animals than anyone I work with." "You really think that?" "Of course I do. Otherwise, why would I go to work in the morning? If someone doesn't get those half-feral bastards out of the slums, who are you university types going to teach?" "An excellent point," Arjun said. "What makes them less human is they don't fucking meditate." "A small house isn't a luxury," she said, then paused. "A small house and a lot of money, maybe." Arjun grinned at her. He had always had the most beautiful smile. She found herself smiling back at him, even though part of her wanted to be cross. Outside, Kiki and Suri shrieked, their small, half-naked bodies bolting across the grass. Their nurse trotted along a half-second behind them, her hand to her side like she was easing a stitch. "A big yard is a luxury," Avasarala said. "It is." Suri burst in the back door, her hand covered in loose black soil and a wide grin on her face. Her footsteps left crumbling dark marks on the carpet. "Nani! Nani, look what I found!" Avasarala shifted in her chair. In her granddaughter's palm, an earthworm was shifting the pink and brown rings of its body, wet as the soil that dripped from Suri's fingers. Avasarala made her face into a mask of wonder and delight. "That's wonderful, Suri. Come back outside and show your nani where you found that." The yard smelled like cut grass and fresh soil. The gardener, a thin man hardly older than her own son would have been, knelt in the back pulling weeds by hand. Suri pelted out toward him, and Avasarala moved along after her at a stroll. When she came near, the gardener nodded, but there was no space for conversation. Suri was pointing and gesturing and retelling the grand adventure of finding a common worm in the mud as if it were a thing of epics. Kiki appeared at Avasarala's side, quietly taking her hand. She loved her little Suri, but privately, or if not that, then only to Arjun, she thought Kiki was the smarter of her grandchildren. Quiet, but the girl's black eyes were bright, and she could mimic anyone she heard. Kiki didn't miss much. "Darling wife," Arjun called from the back door, "there's someone to talk with you." "Where?" "The house system," Arjun said. "She says your terminal's not answering." "There's a reason for that," Avasarala said. "It's Gloria Tannenbaum." Avasarala reluctantly handed Kiki's hand over to the nurse, kissed Suri's head, and went back toward the house. Arjun held the door open for her. His expression was apologetic. "These cunts are digging into my grandma time," she said. "The price of power," Arjun replied with a solemnity that was amused and serious at the same time. Avasarala opened the connection on the system in her private office. There was a click and a moment's dislocation while the privacy screens came up, and then Gloria Tannenbaum's thin, eyebrowless face appeared on the screen. "Gloria, I'm sorry. I had my terminal down with the children over." "Not a problem," the woman said with a clean, brittle smile that was as close as she came to a genuine emotion. "Probably for the best, anyway. Always assume those are being monitored more closely than civilian lines." Avasarala lowered herself into her chair. The leather breathed out gently under her weight. "I hope things are all right with you and Esteban." "Fine," Gloria said. "Good, good. Now, why the fuck are you calling me?" "I was talking to a friend of mine whose wife is stationed on the Mikhailov. From what he says, it's being pulled off patrol. Going deep." Avasarala frowned. The Mikhailov was part of a small convoy monitoring the traffic between the deep stations orbiting at the far edge of the belt. "Going deep? Where?" "I asked around," Gloria said. "Ganymede."
"Nguyen?"
"Yes." "Your friend has loose lips," Avasarala said. "I never tell him anything true," Gloria said. "I thought you should know." "I owe you," Avasarala said. Gloria nodded once, the movement sharp as a crow's, and dropped the connection. Avasarala sat in silence for a long moment, fingers pressed to her lips, mind following the chains of implication like a brook flowing over stones. Nguyen was sending more ships to Ganymede, and he was doing it quietly. The "why quietly" part was simple. If he'd done it openly, she would have stopped him. Nguyen was young, and he was ambitious, but he wasn't stupid. He was drawing conclusions of his own, and somehow he'd gotten to the idea that sending more forces into the open sore that was Ganymede Station would make things better. "Onani," Kiki called. From the lilt of her voice, Avasarala knew there was mischief afoot. She hefted herself up from the desk and headed for the door. "I'm here, Kiki," she said, stepping out into the kitchen. The water balloon hit her in the shoulder without bursting, bobbled down to the floor and popped at her feet, turning the stone tiles around her dark. Avasarala looked up, rage-faced. Kiki stood in the doorway leading to the yard, caught between fear and delight. "Did you just make a mess in my house?" Avasarala asked. Pale-faced, the girl nodded. "Do you know what happens to bad children who make a mess in their nanny's house?"
"Do they get tickled?"
"They get tickled," Avasarala said, and bolted for her. Of course, Kiki got away. She was a child of 8. The only time the girl's joints ached, it was from growing too fast. And of course, eventually, she let her nanny catch her and tickle her until she screamed. By the time Ashanti and her husband came to gather up their children for the flight back to Novgorod, Avasarala had grass stains on her sari, and her hair was standing off her scalp in all directions, like the cartoon image of her lightning-struck self. She hugged the children twice before they left, sneaking bits of chocolate to them each time, then kissed her daughter, nodded to her son-in-law, and waved to them all from her doorway. The security team followed their car. No one so closely related to her was safe from kidnapping. It was just another fact of life. Her shower was long, using a lavish volume of water almost too hot for comfort. She'd always liked her baths to approach scalding, ever since she was a girl. If her skin didn't tingle and throb a little when she toweled off, she'd done it wrong. Arjun was on the bed, reading seriously from his hand terminal. She walked to her closet, threw the wet towel into the hamper and shrugged into a cotton weave robe.
He thinks they did it, she said.
Who did what? Arjun asked.
Nguyen.
He thinks that the Martians are behind the thing. That there's going to be a second attack on Ganymede. He knows the Martians aren't moving their fleet there, and he's still reinforcing. He doesn't care if it fucks the peace talks, because he thinks they're crap anyway. Nothing to lose. Are you listening to me?
Yes, I am.
Nguyen thinks it's Mars. He's building a fleet to respond, you see? Do you know what I'm talking about? As a rule, no. But Maxwell Asinian Co. just posted a paper about post-lyricism that's going to get him no end of hate mail.
Avasarala chuckled.
You live in your own world, dear one.
I do, Arjun agreed, running his thumb across the hand terminal screen. He looked up.
You don't mind, do you?
I love you for it. Stay here. Read about post-lyricism.
What are you going to do?
The same thing as always. Try to keep civilization from blowing up while the children are in it. When she'd been young, her mother had tried to teach her knitting. The skill hadn't taken, but there were other lessons that had. Once, the skein of yarn had gotten knotted badly, and Avasarala's frustrated yanking had only made things progressively worse. Her mother had taken the tight-bound clump from her, but instead of fixing it herself and handing it back, her mother sat cross-legged on the floor beside her and spoke aloud about how to solve the knot. She'd been gentle, deliberate, and patient, looking for places she could work more slack into the system until, seemingly all at once, the yarn spilled free. There were 10 ships in the list, ranging from an ancient transport past due for the scrap heap to a pair of frigates captained by people whose names she'd heard. It wasn't a huge force, but it was enough to be provocative. Gently, deliberately, patiently, Avasarala started plucking it apart. The transport first, because it was easiest. She'd been cultivating the boys in maintenance and safety for years. It took 4 hours for someone with the schematics and logs to find a bolt that hadn't been replaced on schedule, and, less than half an hour after that, to issue the mandatory recall. The Wu Tsao, better armed of the frigates, was captained by Gola Ishigawa Marx. His service record was solid, workmanlike reading. He was competent, unimaginative, and loyal. 3 conversations had him promoted to the head of the Construction Oversight Committee, where he probably wouldn't do any harm. The full command crew of the Wu Tsao was requested to come back to Earth to be present when they pinned a ribbon on him. The second frigate was harder, but she found a way. And by then the convoy was small enough that the medical and support ship was a higher rating than the remaining convoy justified. The knot unspooled in her fingers. The 3 ships she couldn't pry loose were old and underpowered. If it came to a fight, they wouldn't be significant. And because of that, the Martians would only take offense if they were looking for an excuse. She didn't think they would. And if she was wrong, that would be interesting too.
Won't Admiral Nguyen see through all this? Ehrenreich asked.
He was in a hotel room somewhere on the other side of the planet. It was night behind him, and his dress shirt was unbuttoned at the top.
Let him, Avasarala said. What's he going to do? Go crying to his mama that I took his toys away? If he can't play with the big kids, he shouldn't be a fucking admiral.
Ehrenreich smiled and cracked his knuckles. He looked tired.
The ships that will get there? The Bernadette Co., the Aristophanes, and the Fyodorovna, sir.
Those, yes. What are you going to tell the Martians about them?
Nothing if they don't bring it up, Avasarala said. If they do, I can dismiss them. A minor medical support ship, a transport, and an itty-bitty gunship to keep off pirates. I mean, it's not like we're sending a couple of cruisers, so fuck them.
You'll say it more gently, I hope.
Of course I will, sir. I'm not stupid.
And Venus?
She took a long breath, letting the air hiss out between her teeth.
It's the damn bogeyman, she said. I'm getting daily reports, but we don't know what we're looking at. The network it built across the planetary surface is finished, and now it's breaking down. But there are structures coming up in a complex radial symmetry. Only it's not along the axis of rotation. It's on the plane of ecliptic. So whatever's down there, it's orienting itself with the whole solar system in mind. And the spectrographic analysis is showing an uptick in lanthanum oxide and gold.
I don't know what that means.
Neither does anyone else. But the brains are thinking it may be a set of very high-temperature superconductors. They're trying to replicate the crystal structures in the labs, and they found some things they don't understand. Turns out, the thing down there is a better physical chemist than we are. No fucking surprise there.
Any link to Ganymede?
Just the one, Avasarala said. Otherwise, nothing. Or at least not directly.
What do you mean, not directly?
Avasarala frowned and looked away. The Buddha looked back.
Do you know that the number of religious suicide cults has doubled since Eros? She said.
I didn't until I got the report.
The bond initiative to rebuild the water reclamation center at Cairo almost failed last year because a millennialist group said we wouldn't need it.
Aaron Wright sat forward. His eyes were narrow.
You think there's a connection?
I don't think there's a bunch of pod people sneaking up from Venus, she said. But I've been thinking about what it's done to us, the whole solar system, them and us and the Belters. It's not healthy having God sleeping right there where we can all watch him dream. It scares the shit out of us. It scares the shit out of me. And so we all look away and go about things as if the universe were the same as when we were young, but we know better. We're all acting like we're sane, but...
She shook her head.
Humanity's always lived with the inexplicable, Aaron Wright said. His voice was hard. She was making him uncomfortable. Well, she was making herself uncomfortable, too.
The inexplicable didn't used to eat planets, she said. Even if the thing on Ganymede didn't come up off Venus on its own, it's pretty damn clear that it's related. And if we did it...
If we built that, it's because we've found a new technology and we're using it, Aaron Wright said.
Flint spear to gunpowder to nuclear warheads, it's what we do, Christian.
Let me worry about that. You keep your eye on Venus and don't let the Martian situation get out of control.
Yes, sir, she said.
Everything's going to be fine.
And, looking at the dead screen where her superior had been, Avasarala decided that maybe he even thought it was true.
Avasarala wasn't sure any longer.
Something was bothering her, and she didn't yet know what it was. It only lurked there, just underneath her conscious mind, like a splinter in a fingertip. She opened the captured video from the UN outpost on Ganymede, went through the mandatory security check, and watched the Marines die again. Kiki and Suri were going to grow up in a world where this had happened, where Venus had always been the colony of something utterly foreign, uncommunicative, and implacable. The fear that carried would be normal to them, something they didn't think about any more than they did their own breath. On her screen, a man no older than Sorin emptied an assault rifle clip into the attacker. The enhanced images showed the dozens of impacts cutting through the thing, the trails of filament coming out its back like streamers. The soldier died again. At least it had been quick for him. She paused the image. Her fingertip traced the outline of the attacker.
"Who are you?"
she asked the screen.
"What do you want?"
she was missing something. It happened often enough that she knew the feeling, but that didn't help. It would come when it came. All she could do until it did was keep scratching where it itched. She shut down the files, waiting for the security protocols to make sure she hadn't copied anything, then signed out and turned to the window. She found that she was thinking about the next time. What information they'd be able to get the next time. What kind of pattern she'd be able to glean from the next time. The next attack, the next slaughter. It was already perfectly clear in her mind that what had happened on Ganymede was going to happen again, sooner or later. Genies didn't get put back into bottles. And from the moment the protomolecule had been set loose on the civilian population of Eros, just to see what it would do, civilization had changed. Changed so fast and so powerfully that they were still playing catch-up. Playing catch-up. There was something there. Something in the words, like a lyric from a song she almost remembered. She ground her teeth and stood up, pacing the length of her window. She hated this part. Hated it. Her office door opened. When she turned to look at Sorin, he flinched back. Avasarala took her scowl down a couple of notches. It wasn't fair to scare the poor bunny. He was probably just the intern who'd pulled the short straw and gotten stuck with a cranky old woman. And, in a way, she liked him. "Yes," she said. "I thought you'd want to know that Admiral Nguyen sent a note of protest to Mr. Ehrenreich. Interference in his field of command. He didn't copy the Secretary General." Avasarala smiled. If she couldn't unlock all the mysteries of the universe, she could at least keep the boys in line. And if he wasn't appealing to the bubblehead, then it was just pouting. Nothing was going to come of it. "Good to know. And the Martians?" "They're here, ma'am." She sighed, plucked at her sari, and lifted her chin. "Let's go stop the war, then," she said. Chapter 13. Holden. Amos, who'd finally turned up a few hours after the food riot, carrying a case of beer and saying he'd done some recon, was now carrying a small case of canned food. The label claimed it was chicken food products. Holden hoped that the hacker Prax was leading them to would see the offering as at least being in the spirit of his requested payment. Prax led the way with the manic speed of someone who had one last thing to do before he died, and could feel the end close on his heels. Holden suspected this wasn't far from the truth. The small botanist certainly looked like he'd been burning himself up. They'd taken him aboard the somnambulist while they'd gathered the supplies they'd need, and Holden had forced the man to eat a meal and take a shower. Prax had begun stripping while Holden was still showing him how to use the ship's head, as if waiting for privacy would waste precious time. The sight of the man's ravaged body had shocked him. All the while, the botanist spoke only of May, of his need to find her. Holden realized that he'd never in his life needed anything as badly as this man needed to see his daughter again. To his surprise, it made him sad.